everybody, and welcome to our newest episode of Women Seekers and Leaders, where we have the pleasure of getting to know Dr. Gail Parker. I'm your host, Serena Jettolina, and I'm so happy to share this podcast with you, where every week we highlight amazing women in the pursuit of truth. These women inspire us to look beyond the known, into the unknown, and to see what can't yet be seen. Dr. Gail, as her students call her, is a psychologist, yoga therapist, and lifelong practitioner of yoga. She's well known for her pioneering efforts to blend psychology, yoga, and meditation as effective self-care strategies that can enhance emotional balance. She is the author of several books, including her forthcoming Restorative Yoga for Ethnic and Race-Based Stress and Trauma. Gail is a fantastic storyteller, and in today's episode, she captivates us with stories of her upbringing, her personally transformative introduction to yoga, how she made her way through collegiate and academic life, spiritual maturity and immaturity, how yoga changes you in ways you can't predict, and so much more. Dr. Gail, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
I just wanted to kick off by kind of getting a lay of the land. I know that you started practicing yoga when you were 21. One of your teachers introduced you to it. And I wondered if you could tell us just a little more about your first encounter with yoga.
I'd be happy to. I love telling the story. I was 23, and I had just returned back from Pittsburgh, where I went to college and worked for a couple of years, to Detroit, which is where my family was living at the time. And as it turns out, it was just about a year after the 1967 riots that were in Detroit. And the Detroit Institute of Arts was hosting a yoga class. I don't know how I found it. I don't know why they were doing it. I suspect it had something to do with all of the unrest in the city and, you know, just dealing with all of that trauma. And so some way I found my way to this yoga class that was being offered in the Art Institute, and it was taught by a man named Mr. Black. And Mr. Black wore a black suit and tie to teach us yoga. And we did not have yoga mats. None of that existed at the time. There were no yoga studios. There was no place you could go to take yoga. Mr. Black just sort of appeared out of the mist in my life. And so this class was just amazing to me. I thought literally I had died and gone to heaven. And I went to that class every week. It was only a weekly class. And then on the weekend, and once a week, there would be these meditation and sermons that he would offer. So I went to this class faithfully every week, and I went to the sermons faithfully every week. And I was too young at the time to appreciate all of it, but we were given the autobiography of a yogi to read, which I tried to read, but it went over my head. But the practices did not go over my head. And I could just tell that I was just so attracted to this practice. I later found out, and this was after many, many years, I would tell this story about taking yoga from this man named Mr. Black, who wore the black suit and tie, and we would practice yoga in our jeans, whatever we had on. There were no such thing as yoga clothes at the time. And for some reason, I just kept the practice up. After I stopped taking the classes, you would get a book, you'd look at the pictures in the book, and you'd imitate the pose, and that would be the yoga practice. And that's not an easy thing to do, but for some reason, I just kept doing it for years and years and years and years and years. It was not until the 1990s, the late 90s, that yoga studios began to proliferate. And I, once again, thought I had died and gone to heaven, because now I got to go to studios to take these wonderful practices. We have a very strong yoga community in the Detroit area. I think it's partly because Vivekananda visited here. Iyengar first came to the United States via Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is close to Detroit. So, there, you know, it's just kind of in the air. So anyway, I would take these classes. I would tell this story about my first encounter with yoga with Mr. Black in the black suit and tie teaching these classes. So people who didn't know anything, who only knew Ashtanga yoga and Vinyasa yoga didn't, I mean, they would just look at me crazy when I would tell this story. So I started wondering if I had made it up. I did, because I thought, you know what, it sounded fairly preposterous to me as well. And I thought it was a long time ago and maybe I made it up, but I liked the story, so I kept telling it. one day, this is only about, I don't know, maybe about, it probably wasn't even 10 years ago. I was offering yoga, teaching people an understanding of yoga to karatekas in a karate dojo. And after I finished telling the story and doing a little yoga practice with them, someone came up to me and said, was his name Yogacharya? I said, I don't know. She said, I think I know him. So I thought, oh, I didn't make it up. He really existed. So about 6 months later, I'm on Facebook and somebody posts they had just come back from Song of the Morning Retreat Center, which is in northern Michigan, and what a wonderful experience it was. And for some reason, I clicked on the link and it said, Song of the Morning Retreat Center was founded by Oliver Black. Mr. Black used to teach yoga at the Detroit Institute of Arts. I clicked on another link and there he was in his black suit and tie, I kid you not. And then I continued reading more and I thought, oh, I've got to go up there. But as it turns out, he was already deceased. I clicked on another link. He was a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. And I realized that, yes, and I realized that I had been introduced to yoga by a master. And I'm positive that that's why I never lost my love of it. And I'm positive that's why it just got in me in a way that really was transformative without me even knowing that that's what was happening. And then looking back, I can tell you, which I will not bother with that here, but as I look back over my life, I can see that, oh, these changes that seemed very mysterious to me that I was making in my life were a direct result of the yoga.
What a fascinating story.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So I found pictures of me. I have a picture of me. I had an afro at the time that was as big as Angela Davis's. I have a picture of me standing on the steps of the Detroit Institute of Arts, you know, coming out of the yoga class. And then I found pictures of Mr. Black and, of course, Paramahansa that I sometimes, when I share the story, when I'm offering presentations, I will show those pictures. But that was it. That's how I got involved.
Well, I think just like you said, it really does speak to something of learning from a master teacher about how that kind of spark gets instilled into someone. Because I think obviously like you, I mean, I don't know you well, but from what I've read and heard and can sense from you, you seem to have a natural motivation and a kind of natural cheerfulness and optimism.
I do.
Yeah, which I actually wanted to ask you about. But I mean, actually, I would love to know how you found the practice to change your life. I mean, that's a young age to find it and then to continue on. Were you already studying psychology at the time?
I was 23. When I went to college, psychology was chosen for me. It was, you know what I mean? Some people have arranged marriages. I had an arranged profession. My mother and the educators who knew me decided that psychology was what I ought to be doing. So I went to college so I said, okay, I'll major in psychology. I hated every minute of it. I hated studying psychology. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. I didn't get it because it was being taught from a clinical perspective. And I went to, this is a very whole another long story that I won't go into that. Anyway, so the only psychology class that I took, it was called existential psychology. I was involved in psychology on the edge of the humanistic psychology movement. But it was such an intellectualized, it was academic. So they're teaching this academic stuff that really doesn't translate much into, it's academic, it's intellectual. All right, so that's, I just didn't like it. So I changed my major immediately. I switched from psychology to history and I minored in psychology. Looking back over my life, I saved some of the papers that I wrote then, and my interest was always in analyzing the character of these historic figures that influence our lives. I just did that naturally, automatically. When you read it, I'm doing this character analysis. That would always be my, you know, thrust. That was the thread. So it was in me, but it wasn't in me to study it the way it was being taught. So when I left, when I graduated from school, I stayed in Pittsburgh where I had gone to college. And my first job, I didn't mean to do this, but I was looking for a job. I wanted to work, and I found a job as a social welfare caseworker. And so I did that for a year. And my, again, my connection was always with my clients, always with the recipients of, you know, the federal assistance that they were getting. And I always entered into and engaged in relationship with them. When I left there, I came back to Detroit. This is the most important part. So I had gotten married, and I married someone. In those days, we got married because that's what you did. You know what I mean? You got married, you know, all right. So that's what I did. I barely knew this guy. And as it turns out, it was an interracial marriage. So that we had met at a civil rights event. And so we decided, as our way of protesting, because I think miscegenation laws were still in place. It was still illegal in Virginia, for example. I think the Loving case had not been adjudicated yet. It was still illegal in certain parts of the country. Segregation was still the law in the United States in various areas. So we decided to get married to kind of thumb our noses up at all of that and to prove that this could be done. Well, the guy turned out to be abusive, physically abusive. And so I found myself trapped in this deeply physically abusive relationship, and I didn't know what to do. Divorce, you couldn't get divorced in those days. You know, it really wasn't an option. I was coming out of a Catholic background, so I had that mentality. And I was embarrassed that I'm in this relationship that, you know, my parents were just like totally disapproving of, as were his. So I stayed. I did everything but leave, which is what women or people who are in abusive relationships tend to do. You know, everybody's sort of, it's easy to criticize. Well, why do you stay? And of course, you ask yourself that too. I think, I don't even know if I asked myself that question. I knew why I was staying. That's what I said I would do. So I did what you do when you're in those kinds of situations. You just try to keep being nicer because you think that you've done something to attract the abuse. So it was within that context. I knew I needed to be closer to family. So I manipulated the situation so that we went back. This guy was really, he was really, really smart. And he got drafted to Vietnam. That's what it was. So I said, I had a plan. I said, you know, if we go back to Detroit and you apply to graduate school, you can get a deferment and then blah, 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 blah. So he did it. So I'm back in Detroit at home with around my family. I couldn't tell them what was happening. I didn't tell them what was happening. If they knew, it wasn't because I told them. And that's when I stumbled into this yoga class. And it was not until I write about this in a book called Yoga Rising. Melanie Klein edited the book, Yoga Rising 30, I can't, it's a long title, 30 Empowering Stories from Yoga Renegades, something like that. So I write this story in the book. And it wasn't until I was writing that story that I realized it was the yoga. So I'll back into it. So I found this yoga class some kind of way. I'm taking the class. And a year into it, I came home, and I won't describe the whole story, but it was a particularly really, 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 really abusive encounter, physically abusive encounter. And I remember at the time thinking, I just sort of had this I would have called it an out-of-body experience, and I did, but it was really just me sitting in that seat of the observer. I would not have used that language at the time because I didn't know that's what it was. So I just said, I noticed what was going on. I rose above the situation, saw what was going on. That's what happened. And I remember this voice I heard as loud as if someone was standing next to me talking that said, you know he's crazy, but so are you for putting up with this. And in that instant, something in me shifted. There was just this shift, an internal shift, kind of a click or something. And all of a sudden, this guy, he was hitting me with a belt. He dropped the belt. I never said a word. I didn't say anything. He dropped the belt. He walked away. I while I was in that state, I remember thinking, I've got to get a divorce. I can't do it yet because I'm not ready. I'll re-enroll in school because I had forgotten I wanted to be a psychologist. I'll go back to school. I need to save some money, and then I'm out of here. That all of that happened in an instant. He dropped the belt, walked away. He never lifted a finger to touch me again, ever, ever. And I know it was because of that internal shift in me. Do you understand what I? It may be hard to understand, but it was that protection, that empowerment, that awareness that, wait a minute, no. And without saying a word, somehow it got communicated. A year later, I was out. I had gotten my master's degree in psychology because I had begun to remember, oh yeah, I forgot. That's what I said I was going to do. Got my master's in psychology, had saved enough money, moved back in with my parents lived with them for about a month until I could, find a place of my own. And I realized when I was writing this story, I thought it was the yoga. That's what it was. I know it was. It saved my life. I just didn't know it at the time. So what I teach and what I know is that yoga is subversive. It sneaks up on you and changes you in ways that you could not have planned, that you would not have predicted. But it always brings you back home to self, capital S. That's what it does. And so the legacy, or is that what it's called? The lineage of yoga that I was introduced to taught self-realization. That's what it was. And I didn't know any of that. I was just in it and I was transformed by it. And I love it.
I mean, what a very real and raw way to experience that connection of subtle energy and physical manifestation. How energy actuates, how shifts in perception, the mind-body connection.
It's mind-body-spirit. See, I think I think it's really important that we remember to add that piece. One of the things that I have noticed about studio yoga and westernized yoga, as it's being taught now, is the resistance, reluctance, denial. I don't know what word to use. The unwillingness, the lack of willingness or wisdom to include the spiritual aspect of the practice. This is a spiritual practice. Not religious, it is a spiritual practice.
Meaning full of spirit.
Yeah, and it's the unseen. That's the piece. It's that part that we can't, it goes way beyond our five senses. It goes way beyond our physical body. It is the infusion, the awareness of that bliss body. The spiritual body that we're trying to access. I mean, that really is what it is. And unfortunately, at least in my experience in studio practices, that's not being taught. The ones I go to, let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And I would absolutely agree with you that one of the draws of yoga is that it is a whole person, a holistic practice, which of course does include mind, body, spirit, heart and
soul, all of that.
Right. Amen. And I did want to ask, like, were you drawn when you first went to Mr. Black? Was it the physical aspect? Was it the mental, emotional, spiritual? But like you said, it works in this very, there's an undercurrent that sneaks up on you. And even if you are just practicing the physical aspects, it seems to sink into every part of your being.
But what was important about this practice is the spiritual nature of the practice was infused into it. It was physical. We were probably doing yoga nidra. That's probably what we were doing. I didn't know it at the time. And we would do various postures, but we were not doing the kind of yoga that we were not doing exercise yoga. We were not doing physical fitness yoga. We were doing yoga. We were doing all eight limbs of the practice.
What a testament. What a testament.
Yeah. And people weren't trying to pretend that we weren't. In other words, people weren't afraid to say, I mean, nobody was calling it all of that, but that's what we were doing. All eight limbs, and the spiritual nature of the practice was primary.
You said you grew up in a Catholic background. Was that a spiritual practice for you? If that didn't resonate with you, were you looking, and when you found this, it kind of fit inside a spiritual longing that you had?
Well, you want to hear this story? Okay.
Yeah.
So I did not grow up in a Catholic background. I grew up in the military. My father was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, and he made the military his career, which explains a lot about my psychology and the things that influenced me as well. But so when you live on an Air Force base, which is where we were living, you don't have a lot of options. My father was Episcopalian, and I was baptized as an Episcopalian.
And was it your mother who was Catholic?
My mother was atheist.
I guess I thought you said Catholic earlier, and
I'm not done. I'm telling you a story. I'm not done.
Okay.
So when you're on an Air Force base, we were lucky. We had a Catholic priest, we had a Lutheran minister, and a rabbi. That's unusual. So my father would take us to the Lutheran. Would take me to the Lutheran church. Originally, as it turns out, he wanted to be an Episcopal priest in his, you know, which is funny. So we would go to the Lutheran church, and it was scary. It was a hellfire and brimstone kind of, it was a fundamentalist sort of place, and it scared me. And so he took me to the Catholic service, and I thought, again, I had died and gone to heaven. Oh my God, I loved it. The ritual, the incense, they were only using Latin at the time. So, you know, the language, there's just everything about it. So I decided, and my little girlfriends across the street were Catholic. I decided I wanted to become Catholic. So at age 9 years old, my mother, for some reason, agreed. I have no idea to this day why she agreed to this. She was an atheist. So I became a Catholic. And I was devout. I really was. I mean, I threw myself into this stuff, hook, line, and sinker. And I ended up going to an all-girls Catholic boarding school, which is a whole nother interesting story, which is how I ended up at the university where I attended. It was a Black Catholic boarding school for Black young women. Again, segregation was the law. So Black families who could would send their children, their kids to this boarding school. So I ended up at this boarding school where I continued to deepen my spiritual practice. And I'm pretty sure, because the religious stuff, I kind of liked the religion was the dogma, it didn't get in me. I appreciated some of it, but a lot of it I didn't. And because I wasn't raised in that way, I didn't accept everything. But I loved the spiritual nature of the practice and the ritual and all of the stuff that we do in yoga. You know what I mean? I didn't know yoga at the time. So, so that's what I did until I realized, at some point you outgrow that. And I talk about spiritual maturity. At some point in our lives, and this is true for all of us, regardless of your, religious background, to the extent that you have one. At some point, you're invited really to develop your own relationship to all of this and to your own spiritual practice. And that's a scary step to take. Particularly if you've grown up in honoring religious dogma. To cultivate your own relationship with God, with Ishvara, Pranidhana, to take that step can be threatening. You know what I'm saying? To leave behind what I always thought, that the higher power existed outside of me, and to embrace the fact that, wait a minute, that's in me. It's in me. I am that. This is not an easy transition to make. But it is an important aspect of spiritual maturity. It doesn't mean that you don't, if you enjoy your religious practice, you can do that too. but there's more. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I deeply resonate with that.
Yeah, and that's what I'm, so that has been my trajectory. And it's not, just as we develop psychologically, we go through phases of psychological development. We go through phases of physical development. You know, you can't walk when you're 3 months old. You can't. It's not possible. You have to develop physically enough to be able to do that. You can't talk when you're 4 months old. You have to develop physically to be able to do that. The same is true of our intellectual abilities, our psychological state of being. There are developmental phases that we go through. I'm entering a new one now, which is interesting. We can talk about that later. So the same is true of our spiritual development. It isn't stagnant. So there's spiritual immaturity. This is how I see it. This is how I teach it. When we're spiritually immature, when we're brand new, you know, we think, and let's use yoga as our practice here. So you start practicing yoga. You feel great. You think you've, quote, died and gone to heaven. That's what I always like to say. And you think, wow, if I keep doing these practices, life is going to be great. I'm not going to get sick. I'm not going to have problems. Bad things are going to stop happening to me. Everything is going to unfold exactly the way I want it to. That's our spiritual immaturity, you know, where we really expect that now life is going to go my way. It's going to be the way I want it to be. There reaches a point in the developmental phase of our spirituality where we begin to realize, wait a minute, it's not working like that. I get sick. I get disappointed. My teachers, my gurus, whomever I'm looking up to have clay feet. They're human beings. They make mistakes. They sometimes do horrible things. And so in our adolescent phase, we experience disillusionment. Oh, things aren't the way I thought they were. Life is not all bliss and happiness and, you know, la la land. It's not. I think what we call depression is frequently disillusionment. When the veil, when you begin to recognize, it's not working. You mean it doesn't work this way? You mean it's not the way I thought it was going to be? That's a very important transition to understand. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. So you might call it depression and go get medication, for example. You know what I'm saying? I'm not suggesting that one ought not manage one's depression, but I'm saying that there's a difference between, well, you might feel depressed when you get disillusioned.
I was just going to say the truth can be harsh.
It can be very harsh. And realizing, it's not what I thought. Without, I think, guidance and deep self-awareness and probably someone who's already been through that to support you as you go through your period of disillusionment to get on the other side of it, to realize there's more, I think that that's a very tender time in a person's life. It's hard to do it on your own. It's very difficult to do it alone, which is where a community of people, or at least someone who's already been there, done that, bought that t-shirt, can support you through, knowing that there's nothing wrong with you. You are not crazy. You're just going through a tough time, and we'll be here for you as you go through that tough time. So I think that that's one of the things that yoga communities can offer. I'm not sure that they're always doing that, but I think there's the potential for that. So let's say you get through. So if you don't do that and you're in your spiritual adolescence, that's where you're in danger of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That's it. I'm done. Yogis are human. They do dumb stuff. They do horrible stuff. You know, that's it. I'm out of here. Yoga is for the birds. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm done. I'm gone. And then you badmouth yoga. That's adolescence. Because that's what adolescents do. That, you know, they get mad at everybody and act out. And they have a temper tantrum. And some people stay stuck in their temper tantrum. And some people go on to find something else that is more suitable to them. And others recognize, wait a minute. This is an opportunity. This sense of betrayal. There's a sense of betrayal. I don't know if you saw the autobiography of Malcolm X or read it. But for those of you who did, and for those of you who didn't, I'll tell you a little bit. At one point, Malcolm X, who has been a stalwart in the Nation of Islam, is betrayed by one of his supporters and gets kicked out of the nation. And he was devastated by it. But it was after that he recognized, wait a minute, these practices are for all people. This is not just for one group of people. And he stopped demonizing the rest of the world. You know what I'm saying? It's that. It's that awareness that, wait a minute, there's more. But he had to go through that period of disillusionment. And I began to think about all of the people in the wisdom traditions. Jesus had to go through that. Judas betrayed him. I mean, I thought, oh, so this is just a part of our spiritual maturity, where we have to go through that period of betrayal or that period of disillusionment to get to the other side, to recognize that, wait a minute, we really are all one at the source, We're not the same. We're not the same. But at the deepest level of our being, we are one. I'll tell you, this is going to, everybody forgive me for what I'm about to say, but I remember recently being in a meditation group with someone who said, we're all breathing the same air. We breathe the same air that Donald Trump breathes. It's that awareness. We're all breathing the same air.
It's absolutely true. And through this thread, we're connected. And I think that that's one of the important things to remember, is that it's not about dividing. It's not, we can't solve anything through divisive confrontation. We'll never come together as a collective. And, you know, furthermore, I think what you're talking about here is really interesting in that vein, because betrayal is division. And I think when you are met with that or forced into it, and you can speak to this, is, you know, it really forces you to rely and build up your inner strength, and precisely to bring you to this point of realizing, you know, here I am and I'm not the same as you, but I'm strong. And through strength, we can find humility. We can find the connection. We can find the walls that come down, because we don't feel like we have to push against someone else to find strength through division.
Mm-hmm. And that the awareness that what connects us is the source of our being. That's the connection. It doesn't mean that we have to go along with or approve of or agree with or not push back on behaviors that are destructive. We do. We have to do that. You don't get to not do that. I mean, you don't get to imagine that, okay, now that I'm spiritually mature, I have to do anything. I can just sit on my cloud and meditate and do whatever it is I'm doing. Uh-uh. No, it doesn't work like that. When you decide to step on the path of spiritual growth, you are taking on a huge responsibility. It is not an easy path. It is not a safe path. It's not. And to imagine that it is, or to try to bypass all of these steps along the way that require, you don't get to just be spiritually mature. You cannot skip over the stuff that you have to go through to get there. And that's where tapas comes in. That's where our ability and willingness to sit in the fire of our own discomfort as we're burning off all of this stuff becomes critically important. That's the practice. It's not just doing a hot yoga practice, you know, getting hot in the room. And it's not that. It's so much deeper than that.
I would like to go a little bit deeper into that, because I think what you're saying is really, really important. Because I think that, you know, oftentimes getting hit with that disillusionment and the depression or the fear that comes from that can lead to passivity. It can lead to a stalwart or being stuck, or it can lead to just more illusion of putting on, well, I don't want to deal with this, so I am just going to say everything is fine, everything is one, everything is good. And what is your advice? You know, you have such a good lens here from the psychological perspective, coupled with the yogic perspective, coupled with the trauma work that you do. You know, how do you venture into, through this journey of spiritual development, into skillful action of spiritual growth within oneself and one's community?
Well, if you choose yoga as your path to spiritual development, you do the practices. You take it beyond. Yeah, it's really very, it's simple, but not easy. You take it beyond, okay. Anger says this. Probably all of the masters say this, but says that it doesn't matter why you come to yoga. It doesn't matter what gets you there. Eventually you are going to be impacted on the most profound level, which is the spiritual level. Paramahansa Yogananda says that yoga brings us home. It brings us back to where we belong, which means that on the human, on the physical level, on the embodied level, you don't have to give up being who you are personally. You know, we are who we are. But it brings you home to your essence, to your true being, that capital self, that part that never changes, which means that you really do begin to. So, for example, when I told the story about what liberated me from being in this abusive relationship, it was a totally internal process. It was a totally internal process. Some kind of way, I will not claim credit for it because I didn't do it. I got catapulted into that, again, the seat of the observer for real. And I remember, and I watched the whole thing that was happening. I didn't feel any physical pain either, by the way. I watched the whole thing that was happening. Got real clear that I'm crazy for staying in this. He's crazy, I know that, but so am I because I'm in it. I don't have to stay in it. I can get out of it. That was the yoga. I didn't plan it. I didn't mean it. And you can't make it happen. You cannot make those awarenesses occur. You are gifted with them. It's called grace. That would be what I would call grace. Opening to grace, you know, to the miraculous that is available to us and around us all the time. The discipline is hanging in there even when you're not having those experiences. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because, for example, I mean, what I experienced is not, nothing as dramatic as that has ever occurred to me since. And I don't expect, anticipate, or need for that to occur. Because I'm aware that you can't make it happen. You can't. You can receive it when it comes to you. But you've got to do the practice. And I think it's helpful to understand that betrayal is not something that, quote, happened to you. Betrayal, in its own way, you asked me, what should you do with it? So what I teach also is, let's look for the blessing in disguise. Now, it's hard to find because it really is disguised. I mean, it's like, what the heck? What just happened and why? That's where we start, you know, but if you stay stuck there, now you're in the psychology piece. You're trying to figure something out. Well, your mind, as we know, our yoga teaches us that the mind is limited in its ability to what it can do. that is not where you're going to find the answer to a lot of these questions. It's not the right question. It's okay, what is the blessing in this? What is the blessing here? What is the gift? How can I receive this as a gift? Now, you may have to sit with that for a long time before that answer comes to you. But it's cultivating a relationship with your internal guidance and doing the practices that burn away all of the obstructions to seeing with clarity. It's an internal focus, not an external focus.
Cultivating the opposite, praktikpaksha bhavana, and not just in action, but in thoughts as well, even in those tough situations.
Yeah. And just having the awareness that that's what this is. Oh, okay. If it turns out that, oh yeah, okay, I forgot I'm on a spiritual path. Let me, okay, I forgot that. Now that I remember that, what is the gift? Is there a gift? And just opening yourself to receiving an answer to that question, which is different than why did that happen to me? What could I have done differently? I mean, those, you know, that has value too to some extent, but it's limited.
From all of us here at Yoga International, thank you for joining us. This is actually just part one of a fascinating conversation with Dr. Gail. So make sure to tune in to part two, where she goes into ethnic and race-based trauma and what we can all do to come together as a community to heal the wounds of separation. We hope you tune in next week for a compelling and enlivening conversation that I had with Master Liao Hu. And until next time, wishing you inspiration and clarity on your own journey toward the truth.